I was one of the Native American children, adopted at birth and removed from our country's Indian reservation system. I was raised in a small middle-class farming community, but was never told of my true American Indian heritage. It was still taboo back in those early days. The years passed, and in 1987, I lost both parents. While going through their personal belongings, my wife discovered my adoption papers and she began a search. 5 years later, I was reunited with my biological Lakota family living on the Lower Brule Sioux Indian Reservation of South Dakota. I am a son of two mothers and a product of two worlds that had collided, but I have an equal amount of love and pride for both. I'm Paul LaRush, and the stories you are about to see are an attempt to share this true American story of a hidden heritage. This podcast is coming to you from a small studio here in Southwest Minnesota, and I'm here today with Tom Gilmore, former resident of Worthington and a bandmate, and I'm also here with Bill Keitel, who's originally from Laverne, Minnesota. I'm going to let him tell you more about himself, but I think I've got that part right. He's from Laverne, as also kind of a former bandmate. The thing we have in common here to start this off, and I'm going to take this a couple different directions, but one of the things we have in common is, of course, music. We did play some music together, and Tom yesterday told me a little bit about his early memories of music here in Worthington. Bill, I'm going to pick your brain a little bit, and I'm going to ask you what the music scene was like, according to your memory banks, back in Southwest Minnesota, back in the late 60s, early 70s, maybe on up into the 80s. Just let me have it.
Hey, Paul, thanks for the opportunity of showing up at your studio. Enjoy being with Tom and Paul here. What a treat. I grew up in Laverne, and in high school, I played it was kind of a curiosity. I worked in a music store in Laverne that in high school, though it was a smaller town, it had a music store that sold big band equipment. So large amplifiers, Fender and Gibson and Sun and Custom and all the brand names. So we had a lot of garage bands that came all the way from Sioux City all the way to Mankato. That was about the territory. There wasn't a larger music store in Sioux Falls at the time. And he also was a booking agent. But the curiosity was I played in a rock and roll band in high school, and we played in every town in eastern South Dakota. And it wasn't that we were that good. It's that all the other bands knew three chords and we knew six chords.
That was pretty good. I don't know if I know six chords today.
Yeah. It was Thomas Booking Agency, Jimmy Thomas, and he owned the Showboat Ballroom in Lake Benton, and we would play there every 6 weeks.
That rings a bell.
My claim to fame was Little Richard. It was Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry played at the Showboat Ballroom, and we were making pretty good dollars back then when a week's worth of work for a high school kid was maybe 25 to 30 bucks a week after school. We would earn that giving guitar lessons, and then we would go out on weekends and earn the same amount one or two nights in a row. Well, Chuck Berry came to town, and it was our turn to play the Showboat Ballroom, and they needed an opening act for Chuck Berry, but we had just got a minimum wage there of, I think, $25 a night. And Chuck Berry was at his all-time low at that time.
Wow.
And we were going to be the opening act, but Ivanhoe, Minnesota, had a prom, and they paid more money, so we could get paid $30 or $35 each per night. And so we chose to make $5 more per night and didn't open for Chuck Berry. So that's kind of my claim to fame.
It's a good one.
I'm the guy that didn't open for Chuck Berry.
I wouldn't hold it against you, but I don't think we should let Chuck know.
Oh, man.
He might not find that. Bill, what was the name of some of your bands back then?
The band it was called Pandora's Box.
Ah.
And there were a couple other names and a couple iterations. And it was kind of a curiosity. Jimmy Thomas he was an honest to goodness booking agent.
And
in the early, mid-60s, he booked a band that nearly got to number one, and it was called DJ and the Runaways. They had a song called Peter Rabbit.
You remember them, Tom?
It went all the
sure
way
do.
From 100
yeah.
all the way down to in the top 10, and I think it got to number two. And when it got to number two, a British band came out with a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Oh, yeah, I heard of those guys.
DJ and the Runaways was never heard from again.
yeah. Well, you know, Tom, what was the name of a couple of the bands that you played with?
Well, like I said earlier, I think Aardvarks was one.
Aardvarks.
And then we moved into a lot of different things, but probably the best name I think that I ever came up with, we called ourselves the Stone Doll of Sister Brute. And everybody kind of wonders where I came up with that. And actually, back then, there was an ad in a magazine. And I don't know if people remember, but Brute was a cologne.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the term they used in their ad, the Stone Doll of Sister Brute. And I just came up and used it as a name. And so, you know, we went through all kinds of stuff.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting. Do either one of you, Tom or Bill, do you guys remember, you talked about the music store there in Laverne. And, of course, you mentioned Jimmy Thomas. I remember Jimmy. He booked our band for a while.
Uh-huh.
We got him at the tail end of probably his glory days.
Sure.
But so in Worthington, had a little shop downtown on 3rd Avenue called Friesen Music Center. Do either one of you remember that place?
I sure do. Yep. As a matter of fact, his daughter played in the orchestra here, the school orchestra.
Is that right?
Yep.
Pete and Elsie Friesen.
Yeah.
I tell that story once in a while because just a quick little, I don't mean to get off on a tangent here, but this is kind of true. One of my memories is Pete had this little deal. His setup there was if you bought an instrument from him, it didn't matter what the instrument was. It could be a kazoo or it could be an electric guitar, but you were automatically in his Wednesday night band.
Oh.
That got together weekly.
What fun.
And then people asked me, what did he call the band? Well, I had a name for it. I call it Pete Friesen's Band of Misfit Musicians. Because my recollection was we'd go there on a Wednesday night. I played an accordion at the time, purchased from them. So I qualified for the Wednesday night band rehearsal. And his favorite genre of music was patriotic music. So he'd pull out something like Star Spangled Banner, Caissons Go Marching Along, one of those. And the orchestra would consist of a couple of accordions, a tuba, one elderly lady on a Wurlitzer organ, two tap dancers. Now, they didn't play an instrument, but they bought the tap shoes there. One baton twirler who came in, kind of got her pirated her way in. One guitar player, a guy named Kenny Fry. I don't know if that rings a bell.
You had a baton twirler in here.
Yeah, in the band. And then this Kenny Fry played guitar, and I was in there. And then you can imagine that group, and Pete would be up there. He was trying to conduct this with baton in hand up on his little podium, doing his very best to try to pull some kind of a sound out of this group of musicians.
With a twirler.
Yeah. And that was the Wednesday night Friesen music.
Probably be a big hit nowadays.
Well, I mean, you can imagine the hook was you buy an instrument and you're going to be in the band. And then twice a year, we'd make a trip over and play for the Veterans Hospital over in Sioux Falls.
Okay.
And so that was that. Basically, what you were doing is rehearsing for the biannual.
What fun.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my quick recollection. And so, Bill, I'm going to back up a little bit. I want to ask you a little bit more about Jimmy Thomas, because that's kind of a big name around here. He was an official booking agency or a booking agent.
Indeed. That's what he did for a living.
Yeah.
And he booked, a couple dozen bands, I suppose. And he booked bands, I'm trying to think of something, the Unbelievable Uglies, the...
Tom, you did some
Trashman.
You did some of the bands.
Yeah, then they changed their name to Winston T. Fink and the Uglies.
Oh, okay.
And Winston T. Fink played an electric upright bass.
Wow.
That was their kind of claim to fame because everybody thought, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and they were just different.
Yeah. Fabulous Flippers.
Yeah. Yep. Tom, you mentioned that.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Harlem Shuffle, baby.
Yeah. How about the Roaring Red Dog?
Yeah. Yep. Out of Hayes, Kansas.
It was kind of curious for us because he also managed and ran the Showboat Ballroom in
Lake
Benton,
yeah.
Which means the bands that he booked couldn't play the competitive dance halls, which would have been in Hatfield, Minnesota.
What was going on? I recall that.
And so we could go there on our weekends off and enjoy a dance there,
yeah.
But we could not play there. You know, that was off limits, you know.
No, not
that
everybody.
Was competition, yeah.
Not everybody remembers the ballroom circuit from around here either, because very few of them, I don't know if there's any of them left standing. But let's each pick one and see if we remember it. I remember, like, the Hollyhock Ballroom, right? And you mentioned Showboat.
Yeah.
Tom, which one did you recall?
The Roof Garden in Okoboji,
Iowa. Absolutely.
Yeah, they got big name acts. You know, they had Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs when Wooly Bully was a big hit.
Yeah.
And I remember the Buckinghams were there.
How about the Ellsworth Red Roof? Is it Red Roof or Red Garden?
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, it was one down there, Red something. Yeah. Island Park Ballroom, remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Fox Lake.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think we covered them pretty good. Anyway, that was quite a circuit. If you got lucky enough to get in there, you know.
We got as far as, far west as Demick, South Dakota. Little Catholic town of, I think, maybe 60 people.
Hmm.
And it had. We normally couldn't play in bars because we were too young. We had to play high school proms and junior high parties and stuff like that. Our parents would drive. But for some reason, we could play the Demick Ballroom. And even though the town was 60 people on a Saturday night, there would be 500 or 1,000 people at the dance hall. And the thing that I remember about it, it actually had an honest-to-goodness wire cage that the musicians would play in. It was actually had that chicken wire cage. And there was a reason for it, because it got, keep in mind, this nice little Catholic town. On a Saturday night, it got so wild that when the dance was over, they would come out on the ballroom floor with 55-gallon drums and scoop shovels and pick up all the beer cans and beer bottles, scoop them up.
Well, I mean, if anybody's just listening to this right now, we're talking about the music scene back in southwest Minnesota, northwest Iowa. We're coming to you from Worthington. So this area, we're talking about what it was like back in the, it was a pretty healthy music scene back in the late 60s, early 70s. The two gentlemen I'm with were both musicians themselves. And Bill, I got to ask you before I switch subjects here a little bit, I recall you, and one of my best memories is you being in a band. Hopefully it's not just a memory of mine I dreamt this, but I remember a band called Bitterwood.
Oh, sure.
Does that ring a bell?
Yes, yes, yes.
You were in that band, weren't you?
Yes. Let's see. There were two people from Worthington, Neil Ruge and Terry Graff. And Chris Schoen had just returned from Sweden as an exchange student, as I recall. And he had been in the original band that I had played with it for 4 or 5 years. And we formed a band for a short while. I think I just left the University of South Dakota and eventually wound up in Worthington. It was a really fun band. We felt like it was a little more accomplished in some of the things it did, but we really were kind of not, we weren't connected with a booking agent as hard and fast as we should have been. So we really didn't travel much with that band.
If you were to pick a year out that the band was kind of at its peak, what year would you pull?
69.
Okay, that was going to be my guess.
Yeah.
So that would have been, for me, that would have been late junior high years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring that up, I wanted to ask you, is because one of the things that was kind of common back in those days was that there was usually a band, in age-wise anyway, and basically in talent, that was a little bit ahead of you. And what that would do to you and your bandmates was make you work a little bit harder. You wanted to emulate the band that was up on the next rung up the ladder. And so I guess this is a compliment, Bill, but we always figured you guys were up a couple notches there.
We did our very best
to emulate what you guys were doing. And I don't know if we pulled it off or not, but that's what I remember.
I think you have every reason to stand tall and proud, Paul. Man, what a journey you've had over the years. It's been fun. Both Tom and I would relate to this, but it's been fun to watch you and your family and your bandmates travel the world.
I'm going to shift gears right now and take this conversation in a little bit different direction. And Tom, you can join me in some of these questions here, because what I'm going to get into right now is there's no way I could bring Bill over here and have him join this conversation without talking about what's happening as of today. And you have done pretty well with a company called the Buffalo Billfold Company. And just, but not that there might have been an earlier version of it. Of course, you had a retail store here in Orleans for many years. But you've gone through some major changes and advancements in the whole thing. Why don't you Phil, Tom, and I just give us the story of the Buffalo Billfold Company, because it's got kind of a place in the archives here.
Oh, Paul, it's a lot easier getting me started than getting me stopped.
Well, I'll take care of the stopping part.
Okay. Both you and I, about 25 or 30 years ago, set out on a strange and curious journey. I started working with Buff. I'd been working with Buff cowhide and leather for 25 years, and then I had just switched over to buffalo hide. You came into our shop about 30 years ago.
My Lord.
And you were doing one of two things in the course of 6 months. You were settling your family's affairs, and you also had stopped in the shop, and you said, you know, Bill, I got to get out of this band business because I got a family to feed. I'm in Apple Valley, I believe, and I need to earn a living. And this was before Brulé. Within a month later, you came back in the store and you said, Bill, I've been going through my family's papers and I found my adoption papers and I'm full-blooded Lakota Brule, correct?
Yeah.
Did I say that right? And I think I might have something to say. And you know, Paul, that was the best thing that, you know, it really was just a profound, profound moment in my life, just listening to you find this out about yourself. And you eventually went out on the road. And the curious thing is, I did the same thing. At that time, approximately that time, the main street of Worthington was being torn up. The economy was changing. The town was changing in demographics. And a little leather shop in a town of, the leather shops didn't survive in towns of 100,000, let alone towns of 10,000. But we'd had unflagging patronage here that was kind of waning a bit. And that's when we decided to go out on the road and do kind of a road show. And we travel 3 months a year doing juried art festivals. And because of that, we've had the good fortune of running into you in Denver and Phoenix and Scottsdale and Tucson, Cave Creek, Carefree, Wickenburg, Tucson, Tubac, every town in Arrowhead, you know. And it's been a real delight. We've enjoyed it.
Now, what was the craft of your specialty during this period of time?
Well, we just make wallets. You know, we're the Buffalo Billfold Company, so wallets were an important part of belts and purses. And we did some kind of exclusive things where we would sign and number them, and those were flight bags, which were designed back in the early 1940s, and they were designed specifically for flight crew and pilots. Yeah. And we like the design, I like history, and I like emulating history. And so we deconstructed this bag, and we made leather flight bags out of buffalo hide, and we would sign and number them, and they were expensive. It was a full half of a buffalo to make one of these things.
Wow.
But yet we got kind of a niche market. The 737 and 747 pilots think they're the coolest thing around, and we sell a bunch of them. And we could hardly afford to make them, and yet they seem to be able to afford to buy them, so we kept making them. And I think we're up to, I'm just trying to think, we sign and we number each one that we do, and I think we're up to over 175 now. You know, so
wow.
It's been fun projects. And
well, I'm naturally curious about the buffalo hides themselves. How do you acquire what's the process of coming up with the raw material here?
Well, we go through quite a few more buffalo than you might expect. I have a broker that buys buffalo hides throughout the West. He contacts ranchers and also slaughterhouses. They bites them come to the market twice or once every 18 months to 2 years. And we contract tan. We have our own tanning process, but we contract tan with a couple different tanneries. And we go through, I don't know, somewhere between 30 and 50,000 square feet of buffalo hide a year.
Wow.
And we sell our products in Yellowstone and Grand Canyon and Death Valley and just recently the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
So yes, that's really exciting news. Tell Tom and I a little bit about what...
You're turning this into the Buffalo Billfold Show.
But, it's good advertising.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We got a phone call in November. And we have maybe 100 different people, wholesale accounts that we sell products to. And I always like to sell in museums. And not always that they sell the most of our products, but it lends some validity and credibility to what we do, I feel. And got a phone call one day from a museum and said, we'd like to hand you our products. I said, that'd be great. You know, where are you? And he said, well, we're the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. And we're putting together in our gift exhibit, we're a gift store, we're putting together a American Craftsman exhibit. And we've chosen you as the person that does the leather goods. And man, I was kind of excited about that. And it was quite an involved process. It did take us, the Smithsonian is not a small place, and they have 30 different museums. And we had to kind of jump through the various museum hoops with, probably 4 to 6 different people that had to be part of the process. And as of Christmas time this year, they've just opened the exhibit, and we made the announcement this January. We had enough stuff going on, but it's an honor. You know, it's a big museum. The Buffalo Billfold has a little shelf that's maybe 4 feet wide and foot and a half deep, you know, so it is.
Well,
but it's still a big, you know, it's still fun.
Yeah, well, I'll ring your bell a little bit, even though it might be 3 or 4 feet in size, it gets a lot of recognition, I would guess.
Yeah,
the Smithsonian really a little bit.
I kind of joked with him. I said, man, where were you 20 years ago? I mean, man.
we can all say that one, right? Yeah. Well, thank you, Bill. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Very
well, much. You know, and Paul, I'll tell a story. Don't minimize that, Bill, because I'll tell you, when this gets back to Paul, we were standing out in the main lodge out in Yellowstone, and I'm sitting there looking at, you know, I like music, so I'm sitting there looking through CDs, and all of a sudden I see a Brulé CD there, and I can't tell you, I just got this big smile.
Isn't that funny?
And and Fear said, what are you smiling about? And I said, well, there's Paul. I mean, he's made it. When you make it to the Grand Lodge in Yellowstone, you've made it. And, you know, it's kind of fun when you you kind of grow up with people and you separate for a while, but you never really lose contact. And, you know, I think that gig that Paul and I did this December just kind of proved that, you know. And I can relate to your chicken wire thing, because I was nervous about that. And I thought, am I going to have to string some up in front of the drum set so I don't get hit with anything? But it all worked out. But so it's kind of fun when you see people like you. You started with the cows outside. Now you got an exhibit in the Smithsonian. And I'm the one that's just the lowly trucker. I'm sitting with all these famous guys. but it is a lot of fun.
Tom, you really mentioned that, is that the fact that you can see Paul's and Brulé's stuff anywhere you go in the U.S., just about. I stumble it across places and all of a sudden. And it really proves that it is a connection with us. It's with a connection with our town. It's a connection with our friend Paul. You know, music really does make the world a better place. Well, and he's contributed to that.
You guys are too kind. But you do stumble across that music in the darndest places. I happen to see one of our CDs and online, Amazon, and in rare music collections, and it was in the discount bargain section of the of the Amazon music. But anyway, so no, that's just a little side note. But listen now, for anybody who's tuned in here, we have talked a little bit about the early music days back in Southwest Minnesota. I'm here with two other friends, you know, and bandmates, Tom Gilmore, Bill Keitel. We're going to shift gears a little bit here. I'm going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to have a kind of a discussion here about something that's kind of near and dear to me, and that would be the Native American culture. And I think we all have some common ground when it comes to that topic. Bill, just by being in the Buffalo Billfold business, gives you a connection there. Tom, you've been an outdoorsman, an avid rock climber, traveler, kind of an admirer of the culture. And of course, I'm about as deep into the culture as you can get. So when we get back, let's talk about that a little bit.
I think you could refer to yourself as the real deal.
Yeah, great.
All right. So, okay, we're back right now. I'm back with Tom Gilmore and Bill Keitel. I'm Paul LaRush, and this is Hidden Heritage. And we've had a discussion about the music industry back in Southwest Minnesota, specifically around the Worthington area. We talked a little bit about Bill Keitel's ventures with the Buffalo Billfold Company. My buddy Tom Gilmore is here. He talked a little bit about some of the early days in music. And I'm going to give this discussion a little bit different slant. I mentioned that we'd talk some topics about the American Indian culture, and I'm going to let you guys kind of do the questions at this point. And, you know, a lot of times, most of my discussions tend to be around music and the music business, and not very rarely has anybody really kind of picked my brain about some of the curiosities within the Native culture. So with that being said, guys, it's all yours.
Well, I've got books on the Indians. The thing that I find interesting is I don't know how the tribes, how they interact and how they relate to each other. You know, they're different. Like the Sioux, for instance, are not known for pottery.
Sure, yeah.
That doesn't mean that there isn't some, because there is. But then you look at the Navajo, and they're famous for that. Then I lived out in Reno, Nevada for a while, and the Washoe tribe, which is a small tribe, they're very famous for baskets. And some of their baskets, you see them in museums, old baskets are $25,000, $30,000. And I was explaining to Paul that they could weave them so tight that carried water in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that culture relate to where you see cultures in the other parts of the world? Like Egyptians would do that same thing. There's pottery everywhere. And so all these different cultures and a lot of these indigenous people, it's all related in a lot of ways. And I think that's the thing that I don't know why we have to be so fractured.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, Tom. I'll say this on that subject, is that most people don't realize that there are over 550 recognized American Indian tribes in the United States. And of those 550 recognized tribes, there are quite a few that are unrecognized in terms of a geographical land plot. But so there's no two dialects that are the same. So most people don't really think about that, even like within the Lakota tribe, which is the closest to us here in southwest Minnesota, northwest Iowa, and north and south Dakota. We have Lakota, Bill, you would know that. And then we have Dakota, more in the Minnesota side. And then we have Nakota, which is more up in the northern North Dakota area. But all three of those are considered Lakota. So Lakota is the umbrella that oversees everything. And then the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, those are separated by dialects. So there's a little bit different tone, a little bit different structure in the dialect, even then. That's Lakota, which would be the same as Sioux. So the Sioux tribe, which we consider to be one tribe, basically, has got three divisions by dialect. And then it's yet further divided by what we call bands of the Sioux or bands of the Lakota. And there's seven different bands that make up the Lakota, of which the Brules or Brulees are just one of those, and there are others amongst that. So, you know, there's nothing really that ties them all together. And Tom, we start talking about the whole country. You can imagine the art forms are a little different. The traditional music, you know, I think both Bill, you and Tom have probably heard some of the traditional music at a powwow or something along the way. Most people tend to think that that all sounds the same. It sounds like a bunch of chanting and there's seven or eight guys sitting on a drum. And they're doing this chant, and it's like, well, it kind of sounds the same as the last one. In reality, every little line of one of those pieces of music is different.
It's nuanced, isn't it?
There's a little nuance that we wouldn't recognize. And not only that, but then there's differences between the northern tribes, the southern tribes, the eastern tribe, and the western tribes.
So, Paul, that interests me because, because I've worked with buffalo leather the last 25 or 30 years, I've had and I do travel with various Native Americans, Ho-Chunk and Apache and Northern Crow, Lakota. And I really have an interest in the outdoors and specifically wildlife and birds.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we got to do was we were invited to do the Gathering of Nations.
Oh, yeah.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we look at it from a business standpoint and realize normally we do 4 to 6 shows at a time while we're on the road. And this would be a show that we just drive down specifically to do one show for 2.5 days, turn around, drive back. Well, we know financially it's not a wise use of our time. And yet I'm so interested in Native Americans and their use of the way they use animals, feathers in mm-hmm. particular. When I think of the northern Siouxian tribes doing different types of dances, you see a dance that emulates the prairie chicken.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm a student of anthropology, and the word for that is zoomorphism.
I didn't know that.
And zoomorphism is the the human emulation of animals, and in their relationship to even religion and many different ways. But the headdresses that are worn, you can see in Chinese cultures where the shogun wears a helmet that looks just like the back of a falcon. You know, and so I decided I don't care if I'm going to make any money or not. I want to go to the Gathering of Nations because there's native dancers from all over the Americas.
Americas.
And I want to document what kind of bird feathers they had. And at the time, I was writing a little bit for a regional newspaper, and I was able to get a press pass to get on the dance floor.
Sure.
And, oh, man, I had a great time. I got to what got me really interested is when I was doing a show in, that you were headlining in. It was in Milwaukee called the
Indian Summer.
Indian Summer. Yeah. Indian Summer. And I took a picture of a native gal who had a fan that was made of red-tailed hawk feathers.
Sure.
It still just burned in my mind. It is the most, it's the most beautiful natural object that I've seen, you know? And so I headed to Albuquerque to see what other kinds of feathers I'd find. You know, that was the great part of the amazing part of the story. However, most of them are golden eagle, bald eagle, turkey. But there were other feathers that I saw along the way. And I even got to visit with one of the, interview one of the feather merchants.
Yeah.
Who could sell feathers legally because they were non-protected species.
It's a pretty big deal.
Anyway, it was really fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good observation, Bill. I'm glad that you're interested in that. Yeah, it's a very important part of the native culture in terms of their ceremonies, their rituals and things like that. And you know, you mentioned the eagle feathers. Just real quickly, I'm going to touch on this. I had a chance to visit what's called the Eagle Feather Repository, which is a government-run operation. It's based in Denver, Colorado, out in the Arsenal area. What they do there is they bring in and they take in eagles who have been either wounded. In most cases, they're already deceased, whether they've been electrocuted or hit by a vehicle. There's different ways they get there, but they process the eagle in, and they'll separate the feathers out, the plumes, and along the long wing feathers. And there's about four or five different types or styles of the feathers that come off the tail feathers off, you know, off the eagle, and then they catalog everything. And then of course, if you're an enrolled member, a card carrying, basically sounds a little funny to say that, but a card carrying member of one of the tribes. And you filled your paperwork out, you qualify to get on the list to receive your allotment of feathers, which are basically limitless depending on what you're doing. If you're a tribal leader and want to give those out to the younger ones who have made an accomplishment in their life, many times, the eagle's feathers are used in different ways besides ceremonial. They're used for acknowledgments too at major points in life, a graduation, a wedding, the birth of a new child, a major event that maybe of leadership you did for your community, a major sacrifice maybe you made for your community, family, service of your country, military service. Those are all things where feathers can come your way. And, you know, the old story was that when people used to see the old chief in the old Westerns and he had the big headdress on with the eagle feathers going down to the ground, that did happen in many cases, but you got to remember that each one of those feathers came to that individual through some major event in their life. So when you would see an individual with a long headdress like that, you
sure, it just wasn't a collection of adornments.
It was not. It was very
significant. Yeah, not a costume.
And no, not in any way. And the longer the headdress, the more that the individual had done. So that was a pretty big deal. But yeah, interesting observation, Bill, about the feathers.
Well, I remember, Paul, when you were explaining to me and I asked you about where do these dancers get the costumes, and there is no costume shop.
No, they're not.
They're all handmade, and as they get the adornments, is through accomplishment. More and more of it.
It is. You know, one of the things that we always like to say is that, you know, we use the term regalia instead of a costume. And I asked somebody once early in my assimilation process, I go, well, what the heck's the difference? And they kind of chuckled a little bit and they go, well, Paul, they said, you know, a costume is used to change your identity. Like we'd put something on at Halloween to look different. A regalia is an extension of your identity. So when you begin to make your regalia,
you are usually given some sort of suggestion or a hint or been observed by an elder early in your life that says that maybe there's an indication that you might end up being a tribal leader. You might be an athlete. You might even be one of the hunters that we rely on for our wild game. Anyway, as you go through your life, those kinds of observations are made, and that kind of starts to dictate how your regalia is made.
Interesting.
So your regalia becomes part of who you eventually are over the course of your life, and that's why a regalia, the actual work on it, never ends from the time you start it until your last breath.
And most of them are made by the dancer themselves, right?
Many
times. Or maybe a family member, but— You know, if you're not good at sewing, but...
It's not uncommon to be gifted a small part of your regalia.
Sure.
For instance, Bill mentioned the feather fan. That's a very significant item, especially for the women. And many times the feather fan is, there's somebody, it could be an individual who just specializes in making the fans, and they'll gift that fan out at some point in that person's life. It could be added to their... The red-tailed hawk feather fan is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So, regalia. Somewhere... I came across this notion, thought, idea, and I don't know, maybe you can confirm it for me, but somewhere in the last couple of years, some erroneous information came my way, and I came to understand or hear that the jingle dress had its roots in the Minnesota region.
Well, that's interesting. The answer,
I don't have any more.
Here's what I know about it. Yeah. And I'm not an expert when it comes to some of that information, but I've heard a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. The jingle dress did originate in this area, the Upper Midwest. It's one of the newer dances, Bill. It's not one of the longest of the traditional dances. The jingle dress itself, the actual regalia part of the, is adorned by many tiny tin cones. You've maybe seen those.
Mm-hmm.
Those cones are actually the covers of snuff cans, chewing tobacco. Yeah, okay. Many people don't know, but that's where they come from. They weren't around 200 years ago. So that's a fairly new addition, but those little tin cones, how the tin cones are made, but the tin cones, when they bump together, they make this sound. It's really quite a nice, it's a pleasant sound. And what there's... On a full-blown regalia jingle dress, there's one cone there for each of the calendar days of the year.
Wow.
And that makes up the full jingle dress. So when a dancer begins to move into that rhythm and that time, to that drum beat, and the jingles are all moving and swaying and bouncing together, that in itself is kind of a hypnotic part of that dance. It's really pleasing to listen to. But when you know more, when you're aware of some of that stuff, you kind of go, well, that's really pretty interesting that, you know. And so when the young dancers start off, the young dancer might start with just a little dress and maybe 25, 30 cones on it, you know, just to get going.
Mm-hmm.
But, in its full maturity, there's...
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Fascinating.
Well, it's like I say, once you're steeped into the cultures, my assimilation process, which I call, Bill, you probably appreciate this, which I to this day call a reverse assimilation. has been very a life-changing experience, spiritual experience, to be honest with you. But I came into the culture halfway through my life. I was 38 years old when I started it. So essentially it's right at the midlife point or close to it. And I knew that it would take the balance of my life. And hopefully I was going to have enough years to balance that out. But my hope was to balance that out with an equal number of years to catch up with the lost time. At this stage of my life, I don't think I'm going to catch up. I might make it years wise, but I don't think I'll catch up with the assimilation and the educational process. There's just too much to take in that could have been passed along from birth to maybe the age 4 or 5. And of course, those years are hard to recapture. You can't do it. So,
well, Paul, you've done a stunning job interpreting your life, your newfound life, starting 25, 30 years ago, whenever that was. You were 38 at the time?
38.
Yeah. And you've done it in a way that's been thoughtful and mindful of the needs of everyone. And I think of the words you always, in your vocabulary, you use the word reconciliation. And those are important things in any and every culture. I have a question or two, if I can.
Yeah, well, great. You. That's what we're here
and,
for.
And I've thought about this. A few years ago, I had my genetic testing done.
Mm.
And I've seen I first knew you with your original Worthington family. And from there, we got to know you with your Brule family. And, you know, we knew you were bold enough and determined enough. You left the Minneapolis suburbs and went back to the reservation in South Dakota to raise your kids.
Yeah.
In the letter. And those have been such incredible journeys. And now, as I recall you telling me, we always heard you were French Canadian by your adopted parents.
That's correct. Yeah, that's what I told you.
And we always heard that French Canadian. And I thought to myself, man, I've had my genetic testing done. And I got it back in the mail, and it told me where my family in Europe was from. And it was Baden-Baden, Germany. And I knew for a fact that's where, you know, they came up with it just like that in my genetic testing. Uh-huh. Well, I happened to know a bit about that. And what an interesting journey if we could encourage you to consider.
Now, are you suggesting a challenge here, Bill?
Oh, man, wouldn't that be nice? Tom, do you think we could challenge him?
Maybe.
Because imagine you have discovered where your roots are, and yet everyone's comes from someplace else. And if your adoptive parents said you were French-Canadian, that might have not just been Lower Brule. There may be something more than that.
Well, there actually is. I don't know if the answer, you know, is an interesting proposition, Bill.
Could we ask your audience what they think about this?
Yeah, let's put it out there. Okay, so anybody who's listening to this, chime in and let me know what you think. I'll precede that by just this one little comment here, is that you had mentioned about my full blood, you know, genetic line, and I have to correct that. It's close enough, but when I received my birth certificate on there, I was listed as 5/8 in my bloodline, in my true Lakota bloodline, which was plenty to be an enrolled member, and it's really pretty significant in terms of what is still out there today. There are very few what you and I would call full bloods left. Some of them have just been grandfathered in, even though they're not 100%. They're still grandfathered in as a full blood. Well, so that 5/8 leads one to believe, well, what's the other 3/8? and you know, we've always been a little curious about that. And in fact, you know, from what I've seen of my family tree that we have at this time, it goes back basically, Bill, about two and a half to three generations. I've got information on, and there it's that's as far as we've been able to trace it back. And lo and behold, there is French and French Canadian indications in that branch of the tree, so to speak. So, you know, I don't know. I've been content up to this point with the information that we've got, but you know, by catching me on the airwaves here, you've kind of got me thinking a little bit.
Yeah, I've actually played a little music in France, and I think of the podcast that you're doing here. I think this is going out to more listeners than just Minnesota and the Midwest. I'm pretty sure you have international people listening to your podcast.
Well, there is. You know, Tom and I were just looking at it last night. I showed him some of my analytics up here that we've got, and so right now, as strange as it may seem, the U.S. Canada is in second place. Third is Australia. Fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh all comes from Eastern Europe.
Wow.
Including France, Germany, and the UK. And
see, I think you have French relatives that want to hear you perform Paris, Charleville, Mézières, many places in France.
Oui, oui.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think it would be such a valid continuance of your endeavors that you have so successfully put forth over the last three or four decades.
Well, Bill, let's throw it out there and see what comes back. Let's see what the audience might say, and we'll see what the family thinks about the matter too. You kind of caught me by surprise here a little bit, but it's interesting, and maybe it might even be something that maybe we would do if we find that there's some support for it. Maybe we'll even do it. Maybe we could do it live on the airwaves, and that might be sticking my neck out a little bit there. But
It's a possibility.
It would be a fascinating new discovery, you know, no matter what you find out, what you find out.
With that being said, we're going to take a quick little pause here and come back and kind of wrap up our conversation. And I've enjoyed this, you guys. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you, Tom. And from myself, Paul, and the rest of the Brûlé family, I'm going to thank these guys for joining in early on our podcast venture. And we're going to take a short little break here and come back and kind of conclude our conversation. What I want to do is just, we haven't even really scratched the surface, you guys, when it comes to the culture. And I'm hoping that we can maybe get this group together again here a couple times down the road a ways. But, you know, I want to say something here in kind of conclusion. Bill, you said something when we were off the air here a little bit that I've never heard before, and I'm going to use this. You may hear this being said at different concerts and different events, but when we lived on the reservation, we lived in Lower Brule, on the Lower Brule Sioux Indian Reservation for about 7 years. And then we went back and forth for another 3. So we say somewhere in the vicinity of around 10 years. But we had this most humble little place, this little two-bedroom HUD house out in the middle of nowhere when it comes to the Lower Brule reservation lands. But it was significant because we were up on a bluff, I suppose about 75 feet above the waterline of the Missouri River. And we were facing basically almost due west, and we could look across the river, which is about a mile wide right there. But you could look almost from to the length of the river from horizon to horizon, north and south, basically. And it's such a majestic view. But Bill, you said something about another person that you had met that had a $40,000 house and a $4 million view. And I'm going to take that one to the bank, if you don't mind, because that's what we really had out there. We had the most humble place that you could imagine. But it was the most magnificent view to this. And really, I mean, honestly, a lot of Brûlé's music, I think, probably came from, you know, significant moments. Really, some of them just standing out there at sunset and watching a thunderstorm passing over. So, but anyway, I've really enjoyed this. Tom Gilmore has been part of the crew here today. Bill Keitel.
Thanks for the opportunity, Paul. Yeah, we've really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Bill.
Both former members of the Worthington community here, and all three of us had parts of our life in the world of music. And I'm just going to throw one more thing out here. Bill, you gave me a challenge when it comes to genealogy, which we're going to talk about some more. But I'm going to throw one out here. I'd like to suggest that maybe the three of us get together for a little jam session sometime.
That could be interesting. We could probably do that.
Yeah.
Come on.
I got a roll of chicken wire, too.
Okay.
Well,
sounds like fun.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it does.
All right.
Like,
well, just I want you guys to think on that, and we'll work on that one too. So, for anybody who's joined us here, from all three of us, we want to say thanks and thanks for joining us on Hidden Heritage, and we'll be back and catch you on the next podcast. Thank you.